Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today we're speaking with Dr. Kate Filippo about her new book, A Contest Without Winners, How Students Experience Competitive School Choice. In her book, Dr. Filippo, an associate professor at Loyola University Chicago, follows a diverse group of Chicago students through the processes of researching, applying to, and enrolling in public high school, and she challenges the dominant narratives used to describe the implementation of market-based reforms and choice in public schools. Dr. Filippo, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Chris.
So I want to start with sort of what motivated your exploration of competitive school choice in Chicago public schools.
It's funny because it wasn't what I was trained to do at all in graduate school. I was my learning opportunities as a PhD student really centered around understanding schools as organizations and thinking about schools' responsiveness to student needs and how that all connected with the work of different professionals who work in schools. But I returned to Chicago after 7 years away to get my PhD and support my partner getting his PhD. And we had a kindergartner. And that kindergartner went to playgrounds. And on those playgrounds, we started having people who we'd never seen before talk with us about where was our child going to school? Did he take the test? I remember really distinctly somebody in my neighborhood playground talking in really disparaging terms about her neighborhood school and that she was so disappointed that her son had to go there. And it sort of caught my attention in terms of this person seeing so disempowered and so disappointed in this experience. And it just got me thinking about how different people experience policy. That had been sort of a small part of my dissertation that I was getting more and more interested in. But how is policy a civic experience? And particularly, how is losing out as the result of a policy, a civic experience? So what that mom said to me on the playground kept happening to me every place I went, at my block party, at my nail salon, that school choice, which sounds so great on paper, was really problematic in the lives of people, either because they lost out or because they found the experience really stressful. I had someone at a block party say, you know, look what we do. We spend all this money to live in this nice neighborhood, and then we get punished for it. And that just really struck me as like, that's not what I think the architects of school choice had in mind. And if it's not, how did it get this way? And certainly, you know, we parents are fascinating people, but young people are living this out every day. What is it like to them?
When you use the words competitive school choice, how does this conception of school choice vary from what folks may think traditionally as school choice?
To me, school choice, Chris, is about picking. Choice makes it sound like, you know, you go to the grocery store and there's 25 different kinds of toothpaste, and you look at the cost and you look at the different qualities of the toothpaste and you pick the one that best meets your combined needs, but where all of the power is in the hands of the consumer. We might raise some questions of, you know, why doesn't the store carry this kind of toothpaste or that kind of toothpaste, but the consumer is the chooser. And that's not exactly what happens in school districts where there is a perceived or actual limited supply of highly desirable choices. What's competitive is not just that many, many people want to go to a smaller handful of schools, but that there is an element of competition. It's not just a random selection of, okay, you'd like to be considered for the school, we'll throw your name in a hat and we're going to pull out 300 names and maybe your name will be one of them. But that there's an element of academic competition to it or other types of competition. I write in the book both about the process of academic selection into public schools, but there are also public schools that select student applicants based on their performance of a different fine art, such as music or theater or visual arts. We also see different schools that select students based on an interest inventory, an interview, or an essay. Some schools also have their own sort of homegrown essays and exams that they ask people to complete. So when students go through those paces to get access to schools. They are competing against other people. They're ranked in some way and selected accordingly. So that's, to me, what makes it competitive choice and not just school choice.
In Chicago, what were some of the specific barriers that you observed, and what are some of the differences across schools that exist and the opportunities that high schools and CPS were able to offer?
We tend to think in the United States of grades and test scores as objective pieces of information. You perform well, you get an A. You understand seventh grade mathematics very well, you score very well on the standardized test. What's missing from that understanding, and that really factored into students' eligibility to access academically selective schools, was that parents of different cultural and socioeconomic backgrounds had different levels of comfort in advocating for grade changes, had different levels of comfort and ability to help students with academic work. To just as a hypothetical example, this wasn't anything that was shared with me in the conversations I had, but think about someone who leaves their homework at school or leaves their homework at home. And if they don't turn it in, it's going to be considered late and maybe marked down. Some parents are in the position to pick up and go, deliver an assignment to school, take a kid out who forgot to get poster board for their project that's due the next day. Some parents simply are not in that position because of work schedules, because of finances, and because of what kinds of transportation they have access to. So grades can be shaped by processes like that. Grades can be shaped by the degree to which you speak the language in which you are being instructed. Likewise, test scores look objective, but we think about things in Chicago public schools, for example, or not within Chicago public schools, but within Chicago, their private companies have popped up to not only help prepare students for their high school entrance exam, but they also offer assistance to students in preparing for their seventh grade standardized test scores, which contribute to one third of the portfolio score that's considered for admission to the most highly selective stratum of schools in Chicago. So that doesn't sound very objective. Some students know about those tests, those courses, and some students don't. Some students can pay for them and some students can't. And then some students actually take the classes and most students don't. So those were some barriers right there, that grades and test scores are intended to be objective measures, but in fact erect and lower barriers for different students in different circumstances. Other barriers that I ran into were requirements at many schools for students to attend open houses, which were usually scheduled only at one time per year per school. Some students did not learn about those open houses. Others were not able to get there, or their parents were not able to attend due to work responsibilities or competing childcare responsibilities. The other barrier, I think I would say, was widely held negative perceptions of schools that either were located in racially isolated neighborhoods in Chicago, or that had a predominantly Black or Brown student population, regardless of their location within the city. So many students and parents and educators, to be frank, had negative opinions of schools by that description, and therefore students were less likely many times to consider those schools as viable or consider those schools as sort of unwanted Plan B or Plan C type schools. The official barriers, I didn't see many of them. I saw a few, but these perceptions were very hefty and impactful.
So the district, in an attempt to appear neutral, implemented a formula that ostensibly made decisions objectively. What role did this formula play in the implementation of the district's choice policy?
It's a really interesting question. Chicago is Chicago. People like to make backroom deals here. And this was a big problem with the selective enrollment process. Both elected officials and employees of Chicago Public Schools were accused of manipulating different admissions policies to admit friends, constituents, family members, and student athletes to particular schools. So there were lots of problems. I was told when my son began kindergarten that the counselor at his school was really good at getting students into good schools. So that was how things had been before 2009, when Chicago Public Schools successfully petitioned for release from the consent decree, which required court supervision of their efforts to desegregate, since Chicago was one of the last schools to formally desegregate in the United States. So the formula they put in place took adult discretion almost entirely out of it. It just came down with different kinds of schools to factors of where you lived in the city, what your standardized test scores were, what your high school entrance exam scores were, and what your grades were in seventh grade. And like I said, some schools had other criteria that replaced some of those, but those were the main criteria that were used. What this allowed Chicago Public Schools to do is to say, this is not a matter of individual discretion. This is not a matter of backroom deals. The director of Chicago Public Schools Office for Access and Enrollment at the time that the new policy was rolled out in 2009-2010 said very poignantly, we've created the fairest process that we could. And I think about that phrase still, that there's only so far you can go to create a fair process where thousands of students are applying for hundreds of seats. And that's what it was at many schools. So how could they distribute those processes in a fair way? What they did is they tied it to academic performance. Certainly, there are lots of questions that raises. I've already shared my perspective on how manipulable academic performance indicators indeed are. But if we look at this from a sort of uncritical perspective, here are the kids that got the high test scores and high grades. Of course they get to go to their top choice school. What's wrong with that? And one of the things I wanted to answer is, you know, what is wrong with that? Is there something wrong with that? And that was something that really piloted me through the study.
As I was going through your book, it really reminded me of how tracking literature, Carolyn Tyson's work in particular, how often those decisions to track students into different classes is sort of correlated back to those individual decisions. So there certainly is, in both choice and in tracking now, that move to try to appear more neutral or objective. But in that tracking literature as well, there's also examining how students take up the consequences of tracking, how they feel about themselves, sort of the things they internalize. And you've also done that in this book, and you've already sort of described the barriers to choice. But I was wondering how students took up the process, and how the process and how the outcomes, whether they were accepted or not to a school, how that impacted how they felt about themselves and about sort of this idea of whether the system was fair.
Wonderful question. I finally had to give up on hoarding Carolyn Tyson's book, Integration Interrupted, while I was doing the study. I just kept renewing it and renewing it and renewing it at my university's library. And I finally just admitted to myself, you're going to keep opening this book while you're doing the study. So just get your own copy. So I now have my own copy. It's actually about 3 feet away from where I'm sitting right now. And I really liked how Dr. Tyson connected academic tracking to identity formation. And that was something I was really interested in. We didn't really know how to ask about that, but we didn't have to ask about it, Chris, because it just smacked us in the face every time we sat down to interview an eighth grader, or when that eighth grader turned into a ninth grader, or when we sat in classrooms, as we did a lot for this study. So students took up the choice process eagerly and with a sense of urgency. This meant a lot to them. They wanted to pick schools for themselves. They wanted not only to get their choice, but they wanted a choice that would reflect well on them, that would say to themselves and to other people who they were, not just as students, but as people. They wanted to be seen as capable people. Some of them liked the idea of identifying as a future college student, as a future musical theater performer, and this is a chance for them to do that. So they really, with very few exceptions among the young people I talked with, really went all in on the research and application process. As far as the other end, how they process the outcomes, one of the most distressing days of the study was talking to a group of teachers at Vista Elementary about a young woman who has a learning disability and felt that the test preparation course that she took was not really right for her and stepped away from it. She applied to a whole bunch of schools and she did not get into any of them. She ended up at one school that they'd sort of insisted she include as a backup. And that was the only school that accepted her. She was so distressed that she disrupted class, that she left the building, someone had to go after her, and she ended up being sent home that day. To her, this was a devastating outcome that showed that she did not belong at the schools where she had been picturing herself. Most people didn't get into the schools that they wanted to go to. I'd say out of the 36, about 5 people got their top choice. And that's unusually high, given the acceptance rate of some of these schools. I mean, the acceptance rates of some of these schools are 2, 3, 5%. So very few people got what they wanted, but most people did quickly or with a little bit more time resign themselves to understanding, as Timothy, one of the students in the study, said, it's not fair, but you have to accept it. That I get that people didn't get the same opportunities, but this is just the way it is, so you need to get with it. And if you didn't get the school you wanted, and he told me this too, don't be mad at the school, be mad at yourself. And I pushed people a little bit on this topic, particularly people who did not get into their preferred school. One student, Samuel, who is a very hard worker, a really conscientious young man, very determined, very personable, the kind of student anybody would love to have in their class, did not get into any schools. And when I said, okay, you're telling me this is not ideal, but it's what it's going to be. Do you really believe that? Are you really sure about that? Do you really believe the other person in your school who got into your dream school deserved it more than you do? And he got upset with me and said, of course I believe that. She worked harder than I did. She's smarter than I am. This is a 14-year-old. So this sort of sense of students justifying where they did and did not end up was one of the real surprises of the study for me. Some of them thought it was unfair, but in this way of sort of like, I don't like it, but this is the way it is. So it doesn't really matter if it's fair or unfair. This is the way it is. Not all aware that if you drove 5 miles in any direction, you'd be in a different school district where that's not the way it is.
So policymakers can often hyperemphasize improvements on standardized test scores and use these improvements as a proxy for the overall well-being of students. However, you were able to examine alternative outcomes outside of standardized test scores. So what did your findings suggest to you about the consequences of competitive school choice in the lives of students outside of their performance on standardized test scores?
So I said before, Chris, that I was really interested in identity formation, but didn't really know how to go about studying it. And then it just kept smacking us in the face every time we walked in the school buildings, every time we did an interview. So we actually, my research team and I, took a step back, went out and gathered a lot of information on adolescent development, and particularly on early adolescent development from the ages of 12 to 15, so that we could look at adolescent developmental outcomes, particularly academic identity formation. So that was something that we thought was really important to learn about. And once we started asking, we heard more than we ever anticipated. I was also really interested in civic identity development. What is it for a young person to ask something of their government as represented by the public school district and to either get it or not get it? And we were really interested in the trajectory of young people through the schools that they ended up in. There's a lot of research on school choice that shows which students end up in which programs. There's an increasing amount of research that demonstrates what kinds of academic outcomes students under choice and competitive choice have while they're in school, focusing on GPA, graduation rate, college matriculation, things like that. So those were things that we were really interested in learning about and that we did learn about. And what we found was that these different strands really wove together, that to put an adolescent in a situation where they have to organize around a really huge task of finding a good school for themselves when it matters so much to them and it is so overwhelming and almost impossible to do well, that did create both civic resentment, sort of a sense of not being looked out for by one school district, by the mayor, by voters in the city, but also a sense of civic, what's the best way to put it? Almost like civic isolation. Like if you want to get ahead, you can get ahead, but you're on your own and you're gonna have to beat other people out to get what you need. So given that these were people who were still, you know, the 13 and 14 year old brain is a powerful thing. Executive functioning is still really developing. And by that, I mean the capacity to see an end goal and sort of backwards map from that to plan and execute all the steps that are needed to get to that goal. Most humans, and I'm thinking here particularly about humans in Western society, don't fully develop that capacity until late adolescence. And yet you're putting students in the situation, which is really important to them, without the cognitive tools to do it well. Of course they felt resentment. Of course they felt alienation, even if they were able to have their parents step in and help them pay for classes, drive them to open houses, manage spreadsheets, which some of our more affluent parents seem to be doing. Even the kids where it turned out okay still recognize that they've been put in this impossible situation. That's actually where the title of the book came from, was one of the students who did get into his dream school was almost one of the most resentful of the process he'd been through of everybody in our study, even though he got what everybody wanted.
So given your findings, do you have any recommendations for policymakers, educators, families, or students currently experiencing competitive school choice or something like it?
Yes. So I'll start with students because that's not where we ever start. And that's what I think is most important. Students are the people who are really in their corner, their parents, their advocates. And the recommendations I have to make are sort of grim and depressing for the most part, that you have to, as a student, do things that are sort of almost impossible to do in order to get a preferred school. You have to be more organized than other people your age are, for example. And I actually have a section in the book that's sort of dour recommendations for students who go through competitive choice. Pick schools that you don't think you want to go to because those may end up being your best choices. So there's those kind of pieces of advice I have, but also really look at schools. Take schools seriously. Don't conclude that a school does or does not have what you need without visiting it. And that may put you at odds with your parents, your educators, or your friends. There are wonderful schools in Chicago that, because of where they are located, because of the identities of the students who go there, are stigmatized inappropriately, in my opinion. So I encourage students to visit schools and not draw conclusions before they have. The other thing I recommend to students is, and certainly their parents, is don't make any conclusions about your smartness, your suitability for college, how hard of a worker you are, or any of those qualities about anybody else based on where they end up going to high school. There are so many factors that shape this process that don't have anything to do with smartness or determination or effort or one's potential to succeed in our world. It's incomplete and inaccurate information is what comes from the admissions process about those really important pieces of who we are as human beings. Recommendations for policymakers, I have sort of two qualities or two categories. One is really about tinkering. How can we mess with the policy to make it a little less overwhelming, a little less inequitable? And I say the words a little less on purpose because when you have a small number of schools that offer an unduly large amount of unusual benefits, more AP classes, higher graduation rates, more engaging facilities, more interesting courses, more updated science labs. That's always going to be difficult. And we can't, if we only have a small number of seats at schools like those, all we can do to change access is to tinker with that formula. There are efforts underway, a lot of really interesting work being done right now in New York City, on different counseling interventions, test preparation interventions, to increase the chances of student groups who are underrepresented in highly academically selective schools. And that will help to a certain point. It won't eliminate competition if that stays baked into the formula. The formulas are something else that could be changed. In Chicago, the available seats are divided among four socioeconomic tiers, which I could spend the next 2 hours explaining. But basically, it sets out to have people who are socioeconomically similar to one another competing against one another for seats. This was put in place after Chicago Public Schools was released from the consent decree. So one thing that could be done with that formula, it right now accounts for 66% of the available seats in academically selective high schools, would be to expand the number of those seats that are available, or to create more spots for lower income students. There are ways that that kind of formula could be tinkered with. One way to really jam a screwdriver in a hornet's nest would be to randomize admission to academically selective schools to create a reachable minimal qualification, let's say just pulling out of a hat, that students are performing at or above grade level, or that they have a 3.0 or above GPA. Those are certainly imperfect indications, but to have sort of a reachable bar, and then to randomize who gets access to these schools among everybody who is at or over that bar. Given that we like competition, winners and winning in our society, my hunch is that that would create a lot of uproar if that was to be done. So the other possibility is to create a lot of uproar, right? To overhaul this system. So I'm paying a lot of attention right now to the New York Alliance for School Integration and Desegregation and the School Diversity Advisory Group in New York City, who are tackling a lot of these issues right now in a city that is notorious for having academically selective schools in which Black and Brown students are drastically underrepresented. So they have made recommendations to put a moratorium on new academically selective schools, to place academically selective schools deliberately in neighborhoods where integration is possible. Other things that they've talked about are to do away with exclusionary policies like open house attendance requirement, although I don't think they have that in New York City, but attendance as a factor in who gets admitted to schools, behavior, tardiness, different factors that do vary across different socioeconomic and cultural groups, to do away with those criteria for being screened into or out of academically selective schools, since those things aren't about academics after all. They've also just talked in general about eliminating practices that are exclusionary through the admissions process. So I'm really interested in what they're doing. What they're talking about is creating more inclusive practices, looking deliberately at what could be done to make these schools more accessible. They're also raising questions about whether academic inclusion or academic performance-driven inclusion or exclusion is the right way to educate young people. And so when I say overhaul, those are some of the things that I have in mind, is how can districts offer academically rigorous, safe, meaningful high school experiences, or really any kind of educational experiences, to populations where there is so much competition for schools that are perceived of as good. I think the idea of, you know, to what degree we allow competition to determine access to schools is something that we really need to continue to discuss in American society, whether that is the right thing for students between the ages of 5 and 18.
Thank you so much, Dr. Filippo, for being with us today. Again, Dr. Filippo's book is A Contest Without Winners: How Students Experience Competitive School Choice. Next month, we'll be speaking with Dr. Daniel Markovitz, the Guido Calabresi Professor of Law at Yale Law School and the author of The Meritocracy Trap. In his book, Dr. Markovitz challenges the overwhelmingly dominant notion that meritocracy is a well-functioning mechanism able to offer opportunity based upon an individual's ability and effort. As always, thanks for listening, and remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweet.